Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Sunday. I'm still in Florida, in Orlando. The weather's actually miserable. And I'm going to see if I can now take this opportunity to do the third part of this series I undertook for Gnosim, which is having their auction sale in a few weeks, in March the 3rd and March the 5th, I think. And again, I'm away from everything except one book, as you'll see. And but I remember in the catalog, the most interesting part to me, from speaking from a historical point of view, was this first Zohar that was put in print. And I've been going over the last couple of days. It was a big controversy. It's called The Controversy of Mantua Zohar. I forget who. Somebody has a long article in it somewhere, maybe Tishbe or Sholem or something, and, you know, for all the details. But basically, the arguments are interesting. As I tried to outline those who are for and those who are against. Yesterday, I did mainly those who were against, which was an interesting set of arguments. Today, I brought with me, I tell you, I only brought one sefer because of, you know, what's the right word? Can't have too much in luggage. So I brought this thing I got recently. I should have got it before, the Tshuvas of Moshe Provenzalo. And he's one of the people that came out for it in a very interesting way, in my opinion. This is somebody you never heard of. That is to say, who was it? Bornstein or somebody said, who's the biggest gadolim you never heard of? There's a bunch of those. Not a bunch, but there are a bunch. They're great people in their day. And for one reason or another, nobody's heard of them. The main reason has to do usually in the history of rabbinic literature, usually it's a function of the publication history. So this is where Gnosim, Stefanski, all those kind of auction houses come in, because sometimes they'll have either books that were never published or manuscripts, or books that were published once and for whatever reason never got published again. So in the case of our hero, Moshe Provenzalo, who lived in the 1500s and eventually was sort of the rabbi in Mantua, I'll do this more another time. I undertook for someone else to do a bio of him. But here I'm talking about Legabi, the Mantua Zohar. But just in general terms, Moshe Provenzalo was like a private scholar who became one of the Gedolei Ador in the sense that people wrote him shalos from everywhere and whatever. He was an unusual personality. It's pretty clear from what I've been looking at. His stuff was never published. So even though he was known as a Rebbe of a lot of famous rabbis or people who should be famous, like Moscato and the others, but the Olam never heard of him. And his shalos and shubas, which is the main thing, were only published a couple years ago, 35 years ago. And recently published by the Mechon Yerushalayim. I could kick myself because a couple years ago I was in a bookstore and I saw they had it and I didn't get it. For whatever reason, I was just stupid and I didn't get it. And so in order to do this right, do it justice, and especially if I'm going to do him later week, so I had to get it from out of town. This Mechon Yerushalayim thing, it was republished in 2019. And it's very interesting. This is the one book I've had to read over the weekend. Here in Florida, in Orlando. And the shalos are very interesting. And his style of writing is very, I find very interesting, very litvish and extremely direct. Now, he was a controversial person in his day. And I'll go more into that another time. He played a role in many famous controversies back in the 16th century. They even wanted to defrock him. Never happened. And things like that. But everybody, even his opponents, were moted. He's a gadol, gadol sheba gadolim. And these, by the way, the shalos, which come from some kind of manuscript collection that just by luck of the dice was never published until very recently. They're very interesting shalos. I love this one over here. Who is it? Almisha Amar Shakola Rabbanim Roim Varumim. This Renaissance Italy. What do you do with a guy who says all the rabbis are a bunch of bums and racketeers? That's what they're. The Roim Varumim. And the best part is, instead of freaking out and say, shoot him, you know, you're Tzapi Kuris, the Gemara Tzapi Kuris is Maya Hanali Rabbanan, and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, that'd be the easiest way to deal with this, I suppose. But he says like this, listen, maybe he came across some bad guys. Can't say all the Rabbanim are great, you know. Where's the Lashon over here? Oy. He said, well, I, you know, Tabakan Kanam Benim Sim Reik, he says, you know, maybe he met a couple of rabbis and it was a bad experience. Turned out that they were taka cheaters and things like this. And, you know, he goes on to tell the community, you deal with them. If he's in your community, I don't know him, I can't deal with him. You deal with him. Which is a very honest and straightforward way of dealing with the thing, because who knows what the background is. You know, when somebody says to you, Plony cussed out the rabbi, what should we do with him? But you know how it goes. You omit the fact that the rabbi ran over his kid. You know what I mean? You omit the fact that the rabbi, foreclosed on the mortgage and kicked him out on the street or cheated him in business and all that. Oh, that part. You know, that is how it goes. This is the weakness. One of the weaknesses is the response to literature. It's very interesting, the Shalos and Shuvos, of course. But it's always, you know, by definition, it's biased. You know what I'm saying? And what they leave in, what they leave out, and the names are changed, and this and that and the other. I mean, historians deal with this in methodological essays. There's a guy, Weinreb, and others. You know, what are the pluses and minuses of the response literature? And you have to know that when you go and use these as historical sources, because you better know the background. And you better know, do your best anyway. All you can do is what you can do to find out, you know, what are the pratim that are omitted over here? Like I said before, my neighbor tried to shoot me. Yeah, because, you know, you burned down his house. You see? Oh, I didn't put that in there. So if this guy sang the Rabbanan Balcha Rahim Barumim and all the rest, right, probably he had some run-ins with some rabbis who talk war racketeers. It could happen. That doesn't mean everybody is, of course. But, you know, such a thing could happen. So I'm interested, for today's purposes, in the fact that they published in here. That's the reason I got the book. They published his tshuva over here in nice print too, on the publishing of the Zohar, which he said you can do. So let me just see, where is it over here? It's number Gimel. So, one second. It's a very interesting way. Now remember, this is somebody who was born and lived in Mantua, I believe, and on his own efforts became a gadol. And, you know, so he sat and learned 24/7. I'm serious about that. There were several kahilas, as was often the case in Italy in those centuries, which were not identical. So there was an Ashkenazi community over there. There was a Sephardi community and an Italian community. That's usually went. Italy usually had a tripartite situation. There were the shul, or the kahila, that was run by Jews from Ashkenazi origins, and those who came after 1492. And the locals, the Italians, who were always a minority. And sometimes, like in Venice, the Sephardim were divided into two parts. The Sephardim Tahorim, let's put it that way, what they called Levantine, as the Italians called it. Those are the Jews from the Ottoman Empire. In other words, they ran away in 1492. They were not Shmad, you understand? They did not convert. And then you have the Maranos and their descendants who did convert and then ran away and came out of the closet and became Jewish, the Anusim, and the descendants of the Anusim. So those are people who, for one reason or another, made the choice to convert to Christianity. And, you know, for one reason or another, it's too complicated to condemn or not condemn, especially if you're Portuguese. And later, in one way or another, each one has his own story, they ran away. Some of the these Murano descendants, as you know, went to Western Europe, places like Amsterdam and Hamburg and London and all that, and Bordeaux. And some ran away and went to the Turkish Empire. And some went to Italy. Okay? And the Italian states, for various reasons, this is an interesting story, very complicated, I've spoken about in the past, had different attitudes, and some of them said like this, okay, if you come to Italy, to our country, you can come out of the closet and be Jewish, but then you have to live in the ghetto. You know, you have to be subject to all the Jewish rules. Until then, they were Catholics and they weren't subject to any discrimination rules. But now you're, you know, you are. And your Portuguese Jews, as they call them, are not exactly identical with the Levantine Jews, right? So there are two kehillas. In one place they talk Ladino, the other place they never heard of Ladino because they grew up as Goyim, so they speak Spanish and Portuguese. And, you know, some of their styles are different. It's a complicated story. It's part of the interesting mosaic that makes up Italian Jewry in the early modern era. So if you go to Mantua, there was Ashkenazi community. There was our hero, who was the head of the Italiani community, which was smaller. And as happens sometimes, more than sometimes, the different rabbanim used to fight each other, and they looked at different opportunities to diss each other. It's a sad story. And Moshe Provencal was part of all that, meaning he was usually on the butt, on the victim. There was a guy, Zalman Katz, who was a big Talmud Chacham. He was always trying to diss him and all that. But we don't have to go into that now. Anyway, so when the whole thing came up in 1559, is it the right thing or is it the wrong thing to publish the Zohar in the printing press? So he has not a very long essay, but a very interesting one, in my opinion, in which he, like I say, is very frank and very straightforward, it seems to me. And he says as follows. Rosh Divrei Emes, Yegechiki. Let me start, like we would say today, full disclosure. That's exactly what he means. Full disclosure. Ki lo lamadati chochmas kabbalah min urai. I don't know jack about Kabbalah. That's interesting. That's why I mean it's a very Litvish type style, although that's not really the right word to use, because the Litvish were also in the Kabbalah, but not the yeshivas. So basically, this guy's what we call Italian yeshivish, a guy Nigla, not Nister. That doesn't mean he rejects Nister. It doesn't mean he, you know, thinks it's a forgery or any kind of stuff. No. But he says, never my business. So here, he's writing this in 1559. I think he was born in 1503. So he's in his, you know, middle late 50s. And he said, I spend all my life on Shas and Poskim. Things like that. And when I say Shas and Poskim, also Haskalah. Because an Italian rabbi is going to Haskalah. By that I mean Tanakh, Ivrit, philosophy, even some Limud Chol. I don't know how much he knew about that, but he clearly did. And not Kabbalah. That's just interesting. You know what I'm saying? So even though he will deny this, and so did the others, it's a certain rejection of Kabbalah. I don't mean, when I say rejection of Kabbalah, I mean it ain't for me. Okay? It's a polite way of saying it. It's not for me. Because if you're in your late 50s and you're one of the Gedolei Hador in Italy, and he certainly was, and you do believe that the Kabbalah gives you a higher insight into Hashem and all the rest of it, then why aren't you into it? You see? But you know, you don't ask that. So, it's funny. He's being asked a Nigla question, which is whether it's okay to publish in a printing press the main work of Kabbalah. And he says, Rosh Divrei Emes Yegechiki Kilola Manati Chachmas Kabbalah Mura. I never learned this stuff. Okay? I spent all my life in Shas and Poskim. And I'm not old enough. This is baloney, you know what I'm saying? This is rhetorical expressions, but it's wonderful baloney. He says, I'm not old enough to be zocheb, to learn Kabbalah, to be able to express an intelligent opinion about whether or not it's appropriate to publish this stuff from Nister perspective. You know what I'm saying? Like I read you yesterday, that the Rabbi Finzi was opposed to it. He was coming from a Nister perspective. He's saying, you know, unless you're the right age, and if you learn with Chavrusa, and there are all kind of other, and you have to be Mala Kresi B'Shasa Poskin, it's all the kind of stuff. Our hero today, Ramosha Provenzala, is saying, you know, really, I'm not sure what to say. I haven't reached the stage in life that I should be Zocheb to do Kabbalah. Now, like I said before, this is baloney, because if you hold from it, then you shouldn't get, if he was in his, I'll say it again, if he's born in 1503, I believe I'm right about that. And now this is in 1559, so the guy's 56 years old. So, I mean, how long do you have to wait? Especially if you're talking about being Mamali Kresa B'Shasa Poskim, who if not him? You know what I'm saying? Who if not him? So I'm sure, I can bet you money, that the Kabbalists in Italy are saying, oh, he's new, so why don't you? It's an aver on your part not to. But he's saying, Lo Kashai, I'm not old enough. I don't know if this is the right thing to do. The Zohar, as I pointed out to you yesterday, was not the first Kabbalah book published. Depends how you touch up Kabbalah. But books like the Ramban and the Rabbeinu Bechaya and the Rikonati, and even Ma'arech Zel Hus, which is a straightforward Kabbalah book, had already been published. So it's a whole Tara Rambam about the Zohar, but it's not like the very first thing ever being published. K'davi uvda beheter k'dikosav dor dor chacham dor sofrok. And when those books were published out, nobody made any ruckus. So that was a complete heter. Only now with the Zohar, is there some kind of a controversy growing up? Oh, yesh l'saki yedei dvus l'hakirim l'odim mipaz. And I'm not qualified, he said, to express an opinion whether it's inappropriate to publish them because the stuff is too precious. Like Fincy said yesterday, this stuff is Kodesh Kodashim, and only the Kohen Gadol goes in the Kodesh Kodashim. You understand? So it's not that I don't hold from Kabbalah, it's that because it's precisely so holy, that's why it shouldn't be put out there in Rosh Hashanah. So it's interesting, he's saying this. Ach ena chelki l'shol davar, but I'll answer best as I can, since I was asked Yishayla, ki achar sheruba k'maruba aleha hadvarim b'amadarim halol osim, since it's such a big controversy raging right now in Italy, and some are for and some are against, remember the Maran Padua was against it, and this guy, Marshall Provençal and Maran Padua, they had their share of big fights, believe me, but that's not for today. Ve'elu l'maran Padua, each side has rayas. Afi yunach shalei divrei misnagdin, so now he approaches it, like I say before, from a very neglect, literature perspective. Let's say, I find it very interesting. Let's say that both sides have good arguments, right? The rabbis who say it's usher to publish it, or it's the wrong thing to publish it, versus those who say it's the right thing to publish it. And let's get both spot on that each one has good arguments, because they're all big rabbanim. Well, then guess what? It's a bayadalav shetav. In other words, it's like a teku type situation. But you want to know something? What do you do? Is this a suffix? What do you do in a case like this of a suffix? Is this a suffix deraisa or a suffix rabbanim? If it's a suffix deraisa lahachmer, a suffix rabbanim lakula, right? Lahako. You know that. Which would mean, if this question over here was appropriate to print and published the Zohar, the print form. Does that touch on an Issur Deraisa? Possibly. Or does it touch on Issur Rabbanan? And if it's a Deraisa, then you have to be machmer and not print it. If it's a Rabbanan, then the opposite, then you can print it. She says, I'm sure here, Hov ein kan el dror Rabbanan, she is a Deraisa vade ein kan. I mean, what kind of Issur Deraisa? Show me a pasuk in the Torah. Seriously, he's saying. That's what I mean, very literally. Show me a pasuk in the Torah where it says it's also to publish Kabbalah. Right? There's no pasuk like that. I'm paraphrasing. He's not rejecting the Talmudic tradition of Ein Dorshin, Rayas Be'echod, and then Maisim Rakov, and Maisim Rakov, and Maisim Breishis, and all that stuff. Yes, that's in the Mishnah. No question about that. Is that rabbinic or biblical? Are they expressing a Torah-dicka prohibition or a rabbinic prohibition? That's a very interesting way to look at it as far as I'm concerned, right? Masha Amru, Ein Dorshin, B'Merkava, Maisa Breishis, Yiyamish, Masha Yiyu, whoever that is, V'chein, Masha Amru, Dvarim Shabal Peh, Yiyat Torah Shum, B'Ksav, Milvam, Masha Otim, Shum, Eislas Hashem, Kol Atzimu, Shul, Yisur, Zev, Ikro, Ein El, Medivrein, right? This whole thing is a, what do you call it? It's a Rabbanan. Now, to tell you the truth, me, myself, and I, you could say like this, Dvarim Shei B'Ksav, Yat Torah Shem L'Peh, and so forth, that's based on a drasha and the pasuk, Ki Alpi Advarim O'Ela Karati V'Chabris Es Yisrael. I think most people know that. Yeah? That's one of those famous gemaras. Alpi Advarim O'Ela, Dvarim Shei B'Peh, you can't make B'Ksav, Dvarim Shei B'Ksav, you can't make L'Peh. Why don't you call that a deraisa? I've seen the footnotes, and again, I'm here, stuck in lonely Florida, he says that has a long discussion on this? The Birki, the Chidah, in a number of places. Whether this is to put Kabbalah out there is a Deraisa or Drabbanan. And maybe he's referring even to the general rule of writing down Torah Shabbat Peh and all that stuff. Re'ei Sedei Chemed, Pesach HaSodah, apparently Sedei Chemed also has on this. That's just an interesting subject. It's like a lam d'shel, it's a d'oraisa or d'rabbanan. But he, our hero, says it's d'rabbanan. Azlina baser klala kisveka d'rabbanan l'kula. V'lama yechal ha'osem me'asher hu omel v'neni me'giyu ba'meshelo t'nagiyu ho'chakum mor misravade. If it's a d'rabbanan at the most, right? And there are important opinions from big rabbanim, from gedolim, arguing for and argue against. It's a subject rabbanim lekula, and if this guy is putting in time and effort to publish the book, why should he stop? The guy's working. In other words, let's say he publishes this, which you know they did. I mean, that's what they're auctioning in Gnosim. They did. What is exactly wrong with that? It's a business venture. You invest the money, you put in the time and the effort, you do the printing malacha, you do the proofreading and all the rest of it, you're entitled to a profit. What's wrong with that? When there's no hochacha gemura, misirvade, when there's no isir drum. Now, you can't tell somebody because it's a suffix drabon, and suffix drum is a kula. Meaning, the daito, or das zelosa, of a samcha, royim lis machalehem, aim lachto levad meisik rishut samutr. I mean, to the people who's doing the publishing, not only are they doing something that's allowed, kim esek mitzvah melecha shamayim, they're actually doing a public service. Right? Notice, if you see sofer drabon lekulam, what does it mean? You can go like the one who says, it's okay. The ones who say it's okay are saying, not only it's okay, it's a mitzvah. They're saying, to publish the Zohar and Kabbalah in general is a plus. It'll help Yiddishkeit in whatever way. Right? In whatever way. I think historically, it certainly intensified the cultural insularity without which Orthodox Judaism cannot survive in one degree or another. And so, what's the guy doing wrong? And then he goes on with the argument that was mentioned yesterday. These things have been put down on paper in manuscript form. In other words, now listen closely. The history of manuscripts is an interesting one. This is me talking, just my opinion. Manuscripts are very interesting because it depends what was a book before the printing press, before the 15th century. What's a book? And the answer is, a book is I write it and then I give it to others to make copies. If I write it and do not give it to others to make copies, it's not a book. When the Rambam says very famously in the introduction to Mishneh Torah, that once upon a time the Torah was all Baal Peh, you're not allowed to write anything down. He didn't mean that a person couldn't write something down for themselves. It just meant that you couldn't give it out and make copies and make a book. You give it out, that's very important. If you live in the time of David HaMelech, or, Yeshua Ben Nun, or whatever, and you were a student of Torah, and there weren't any texts because it was all oral, and you had a Rebbe, and let's say, for argument's sake, your Rebbe was a Shlomo Melch, and Shlomo Melch gave talks in however he gave it, because Igeris, Ashur, you're going to say you could do it any way you want. And he says, I'm going to tell you about 39 different Melachas. I mean, do you have to sit there literally and memorize them? If you can't memorize them because you don't have a perfect memory, so tough luck? No. You, the individual student, could have a pencil and paper. And you could write down, class notes. Just don't give them to others that should become the book. That's what you couldn't do. So when it comes to Kabbalah, do you think, even according to the from a Kabbalah, way back in time, Shem Ben Yochai and all that, and before, people who study Kabbalah, literally were not allowed to put something down on paper. What if the guy has, trouble? Like you do sometimes, or they used to do before all the books came out, when you have a hard Gemara and Yevamos, you have to figure out the mother-in-law, brother-in-law, all this other kind of stuff. Or in Nida, all those things that are complicated. So you want to make a note just to get it clear in your mind. Am I right? You've done this. And except now, maybe with the Masifta and the other, they have charts for you. But you know what I mean. Is there something wrong with that? Do I say I can't do this because I can't keep the chart in my head? What's wrong with me writing down for myself, just, different stuff, just to keep it clear in my own head? I'm not giving it to someone else to do. I'm certainly not putting it out there to be copied by others. But for me, myself, and I, to help me, what's wrong? That was the old way of Kabbalah also. Guess what, buddy? That's the Kisvei Arizal. They had the Arizal in Tfas. He met Chaim Vital. They talked for a couple years, and then he dropped dead. The Arizal. Chaim Vital lived another 50 years. And he wrote all this stuff down and rewrote it. Not to publish. He didn't want anybody else to make copies of it. That's a famous part of the story. They stole part of it when he was sick. And after he died, they opened the coffin and all this other stuff. There's all stories about that. But Chaim Vital never said, hey, Dvorim Nister, Iyata Rishoy Lichtov. You know what I'm saying? But on the other hand, what I mean is he didn't interpret that literally. He couldn't put anything down on paper. But he did interpret it in the sense that you can't make a book out of it. I don't want others to copy it. You see? And so that's what our hero is talking about. He's saying, well, it's been the story for the last couple hundred years. Kabbalistic stuff has been out there for copying purposes. The Zohar, for example, to whatever degree it was, I mean, before the printers got a hold of it and did what they did. So in the old manuscript form, it was understood among the cognoscenti that, you know, here's a copy of the Zohar or something like that. Let's say, for example, for argument's sake, this week's is Parshas Tetzaveh, just for the heck of it. So I get a hold, and I was living in the 1300s, and I'm interested in what the Zohar has to say in Parshas Tetzaveh. Nothing wrong with that. And I get a hold of a copy, and I copy it out. And now I have my own notes. And no one's supposed to have any objection to that if I'm a Bar Hochi, right? Let's say I'm a student of Kabbalah or something like that. So the guy who had the original copy I'm copying from didn't make an argument about that. No one said, no, you have to keep the secret and no one should make a copy of it. That's what our hero is saying. He's saying for a couple hundred years now, copies of books circulating in manuscript form. I say a manuscript book. You know what I'm saying? A manuscript book. That's been around, and nobody's been complaining about that. The first step is now that he's doing it in a printing press. That's a very interesting time. So again, ever since this stuff has been put down in books, not printing press, but in books, may us nechshul for some. It's public knowledge then. Wait, why? Because it's not printed in a printing press? But it's around. He quotes the whole thing of the Rama. I won't go through all that. And Umay Yosef Hatfus. So then what does it matter if you're doing it in a printing press? It's around. What's going to happen? I mean, how's it going to change the Pearsum if it just comes out of printing press, which is open to thousands? If they want to, they could get it now already from other manuscripts. Painless topic, you'll know from how you... There's no suffix to me, he says. The Rambam talks about coming from a completely different angle. As you know, in the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim, he discusses Maaser Breishis and Maaser Merkabim his way, the philosophical way, physics and metaphysics. So Maaser Merkabim would be metaphysics. The science there, Aristotelian science and metaphysics, with the Rambam's unique Jewish twist, of course. So, and the Rambam says, you know, I'm justifying it, putting it out there, because, you know, I'm explaining it in the right way. So, I mean, that's what the, otherwise, why the Rambam put out for publication the Mor Nevuchim either. L'shitaso, if that's real, Shita's the Rambam, if that really is the Maaser Merkabim, Maaser Breishis, you shouldn't put it in a book form to be published. But he did. Okay? So how's this different? Okay? Hayotzi mizeh, shekol shenitin likosif, litin lahadfis. If you tell me something is allowed to be written, and I repeat, he means written, and people make copies of it, making copies, then there's no difference if you're doing that and putting in a printing press. Shekol shenitin likosif, litin lahadfis. Vein bin chiber besefer lahadfis akon. There's no difference between making copies, many copies, from, you know, copying out manuscripts and making more and more copies, which is how our ancestors lived. Listen, from the time way back when until the 15th century, that's what books were. People just copied out from previous copies. That's what the Gemara was. That's what Rashi and Tosfos are. That's what all the Rishonim are. That's what all the, you know, the philosophy, Mor Nevuchim, Chavis Halvavis, Kuzri, and all the rest. There weren't a printing press. You got a hold of a copy, and you made a copy, or you hired somebody to make a copy, or something like that. Meaning, physically, you wrote it out. So what's the difference between that and Hatfasoso? Mikana Niyomer, Ki Omer Lib Limnoa Bar Hatfasas, Sefer Mepasa Chibur Atzmo, Hari Hu Mischakim Al Mechabro Umineged Kovanasa. Anybody who wants to prevent a book from being printed, you're violating the das of the author. Because if I wrote a book, let's say, for example, the time of Rashi, and a sefer, and there wasn't a printing press. So I wrote it out in manuscript form, obviously. Saviad. And I gave it for others to make copies. It's evident that the whole reason I put it down on paper in the first place was to publish it in the old pre-printing press publishing way that it should get out there. So that means any mechaber wanted it should get out there. So if you're saying you can't put in a printing press, you're going against the das of the mechaber. U'menaged l'kavanaso. Kihu pal v'asa l'fi mashal rolis agas rabin. Any rabbi who wrote a sefer connected with Torah, with a nigla nister, in his opinion, he was being bezakeh to rabbim. Whether or not he is, that's for the rabbim to figure out. Get what I'm saying? That's, you know, the marketplace of ideas. And you, who are saying, no, you can't put this out there, can't print it, you're like, you're mechashel of tifla, you're assigning that he's a tiflis, a fool, a bad, and you're trying to stop him. He's talking to Rav, and again, he quotes from the Rambam, and so on and so forth, from the Mor Nevuchim. So you see, the Nicholas stuff he knew, the Mor Nevuchim stuff he knew. The Nistra stuff, he's not doing it. The Rambam himself says, as I told you before, I don't want to read the long piece from the Rambam, but the Rambam held that his Mor Nevuchim stuff is Sisrei Torah. And if you remember, he talks in Hilchos, at the beginning of the Yadah Chazaka. What is it? Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah. He talks about stuff which is Sisrei Torah and all the rest of it. And he's putting it out there, okay? So having read the whole thing, Ein Sofik Shizum Midas Kol Bal Nefesh Sheva Tov, that's the way of everybody who wants to benefit the public. Sheishma Midas Kon Lashpil Acherin Neva Tov Mibalov. You want to share the wealth, the intellectual wealth. V'im Bizmanenu Zeh K'Bizman HaRav L'Fonov Asher Babanasinu Rabu Shabrabu. Because of our sins, Paskin Mena Kabbalah Piyish Mishbish. Today, how's anybody supposed to be able to get a Kabbalah? Assuming that it's not baloney, which he does not think it's baloney. How are you supposed to get it? Ishmi Piyish? Yeah, that is the old way. Ishmi Piyish. That ain't happening now. It's the 16th century. Where do you find, if you go to Eretz Yisrael, or this place or that place. But the average person out there, L'shem Shemayim, wants to get a taste of the Kabbalah or more, can't do it, mish, right? Paskin mena kabbalah pi ish mish. Ma'ad hu asher lefonein ma'alim pi sofrim. There's very little left over from sofrim. Ki mivsparim b'apim rechayim. Today is book. So if you want to learn Kabbalah, you want to learn anything else, you do it from book. Now, our hero here, the Moshe Provençal, is famous for saying that, today most people don't have rabbeim. In the traditional sense, it's mostly what you learn is from books. That's always been a fight down the centuries, from Sofrim or from Sfarim, that kind of idea. And that's just an interesting thing, because if you learn from a Rebbe, and he teaches you this and this and this, right? Just for argument's sake, he teaches you something about, I don't know, Migu. And you had him in, it was a good 12th grade Rebbe, he really was. But then you go and continue learning. I'm just making this up. And you come across this sefer and that sefer and this thing and that thing. And you see, actually, the way Rebbe said it was not the whole thing. And maybe it was even wrong. Now, who are you going to go like? You say, well, the Rebbe that I had, and he was a Rebbe of mine, because I had a keshe with him, and it was inspiring to me. And seriously, we really had a Rebbe Talmud relationship. But now that I'm looking, again, I'm just making up, at the ksos, and at the this, and at the that, stay chemin, whatever. I see, it's a lot more complex than he just presented to me, right? So do you say like this, I can't go and follow what all the Sfarim say from the Gra and like the Yonos Abishus and the Kazos, and you know, Digris Moshe and all the rest of it, because my Rebbe back there in the 12th grade or first year or second year base medish told me different. We don't do like that anymore. You understand? We say if your knowledge increases from books and you're not lying, you know, you're an honest person, then you're going to follow where the truth leads you as best as you can tell. That's what you're supposed to do. So he's saying we live in this, such an era. And a third point, writing out by hand and printing by printing press is basically the same thing. There's no difference in the quality of the writing, except that one's expensive and one isn't. As Shazel, Rove, Bekone, Uknaf, Avra, Masun, Masun, Kamazuzi, Shavi. Except when you hire somebody, and this is the old world, to write out a book. Suppose, just for argument's sake, I like the Kuzri, and I live way back when before the printing press. Unless I'm very good and I'm calligraphic, you know, I have good handwriting and all the rest of it, I have the time and the patience, how am I going to get a hold of a Kuzri? The answer is, you'd pay somebody who either has already written it out or to write it out. It's going to cost you bucks because it's a manual process. Beknaf, you know, with a quill, as he calls it over here, Bekona Beknaf, Evron, you know, with a leaden quill, Masun, Masun, it's got to go slowly, Kamazuzi Shavi, it's going to cost a lot of money because of the man hours. But there, on the other hand, now that we have a new thing called the printing press, Beit Barzel Voferis, Mahir Bimlachto, obviously that it's metal, you know, printing blocks, you know, the letters in the press, Yotzi Bashar Zul, it'd be much cheaper. So I can spend $1,000 to get a copy of the Kuzri, or I can spend $10. Right? What's the difference? V'kim shaposhat aminig lahater b'chad menayun, and we see that the use of the printing press has spread, and everybody accepts it, u'maisim b'chol yom lahatik asfar mehem b'ksav ayat, and people now, it's become commonplace to take books that used to be copied out by hand and now put into a printing press. Shkulim hei maksav ha'huva ha'tefus. Then there's no difference between, you know, handwritten and tefus. In other words, don't tell me, no, don't print the Zohar. Keep the old system where only it should be written out by hand. You're not saying don't write it out by hand. You don't say don't make any copies of the Zohar. So I'm saying to you, he says, there's no difference between the two, except one's cheaper. No, it's more economical. And you see people it's a lozu abzu, you know, that you see that people are being knowing heter to publish things. There's stuff out there, I think he means the Rikanati, but I'm not sure. They've already published books that have deeper stuff than the Zohar. Now, I don't know how he knows that. Umanishtanu elam elu. Right? Tien ha'kol b'zeh k'din chelik mishpat echad ha'mikochad ha'tera. Klol demilsa ha'defus l'masha b'ksav v'nitli kosev, in the sense that it's dealing with written texts. And those texts are copied out by others, typically, in the past. Then you know, Malav Lomoid, you're doing a good thing, not a bad thing. Even though he says himself he never read the stuff. And that's from Moshe Provenzali, et cetera, in the late 1550 Kislev. It'd be late 1557, actually. Okay, Mantua. So I think it's a very interesting way of approaching it. It's not a Kabbalistic way of approaching it at all. Seems to me a halachic way and a straightforward logical way. That's what I mean, literally. Now, the Zohar was published, of course. That's what they're putting in the auction house next week, or March 3rd and March 5th. And it did result in a tremendous increase in interest in Kabbalah in Klal Yisrael. As was the case with all the printed stuff. It did result in all kind of unexpected things including Shabtai Tzvi and stuff like that. But overall, if we ask ourselves the question, what's been the result of the publication, putting it into Rishus HaRabim, of the Zohar and then the Kisri Ari stuff and all the other books that go along with it, as I said before, it has unquestionably intensified the cultural insularity of the Jewish people. It moved everything to the right. And, you know, you could make the case that in the modern era, when the undertow of the general surrounding civilization is so far to the left, I said before, if the Orthodox Judaism certainly can't survive without a certain healthy dose of cultural insularity. Now, how much cultural insularity has always been a debate. And there's no such thing as one size fits all. A Satmar guy's over here, a Wayu guy's over there, you know, something like that. But nevertheless, both of them agree that you need a certain amount of cultural insularity. You know, in fact, a nice dose of it. Those Jewish groups that oppose what I just said, and like in principle oppose the cultural insularity, even though sometimes they use that rhetoric, but they have not survived. They're on the way out. If you look at the non-from types of Judaism, precisely because they kind of abandoned the concept of cultural insularity, their people know the Galician stuff, they don't know the Jewish stuff. You know, that's what is plain and simple. And the results have been devastating. I'm talking about from a demographic and, you know, sociological point of view. How much cultural insularity is a different story. You know, some people will, you know, I mean, like I said before, you can be Satmar and say if you have the buttons on the wrong side of the shirt, you're not culturally insular, you're doing an Avera. I get that. But each one finds its way somewhere along the spectrum. But the spectrum is pretty much in the direction of cultural insularity. Some people can do with college, some people do without college. Still, it's a certain amount of cultural insularity. And even though modern culture tells you that cultural insularity is a dirty word, really, they say it's a dirty word. Alpha became, there's no other way for a small group like the Jewish people to survive. And the Kabbalah has proven to be a major factor in this, obviously. It's weird that in the 20th century, now I'm just taking a grand sweep over here, the secular got into Kabbalah in an unusual way, you know, starting with Gershon Scholem and all the people that followed him. And, you know, it's a big academic discipline and all the rest of it. But, and you end up with the weird thing that, you know, people are not from and don't know the, you know, post-Gim or anything like that, Shas, and they're familiar with some degree of Kabbalistic literature. They write dissertations on it and things like that. It's a little weird. But that's the times in which we live. I'm talking about the modern era. But nevertheless, the spread of Zohar, which I can't say today is a common book, even though they come out with these new things. I myself never got into the Masechet Midrash. But, you know, I have my own things. And certainly I never got into the Sulam. I have it, but I know it doesn't talk to me. But there, you know, and the Zohar is what it is. And aside from the whole question of the forgery and all that, which is always, you know, people always writing me all the time about, as a historic fact, the rise of Kabbalah has, as they say before, been something that has strengthened the internal cohesion of the Frum Jews. Even the Litvisha, who don't have anything to do with Kabbalah generally, rely on it as a hinterland. So when you see something that doesn't make sense in the Shas or the Chumash or anything like that, they'll make you say, oh, that's like some Kabbalistic thing. And this, of course, is based on the fact that the very Bible of the literature world is the, you know, Chaim V'Loshen, it's the Nefesh HaChaim, which is all Kabbalistic. It's all quotes from the Zohar and from, extensive quotes, by the way, as you know, from the Zohar and the Kisvei Ari. And so I'm not saying every guy in Yeshiva learns that or understands it and all the rest of it. Imagine before they started these new editions, you know, with the translations from the Aramaic. But this is what they've always fallen back on. And so it is strange how the Hashgacha Pratis has worked, but you can understand those who are opposed to it also. Right? You can understand those who are opposed to it. But since you had big rabbis like Moshe Provenzalo, precisely because he wasn't a Mekubal, precisely because he was, as I say before, you know, a Litvish style, As he himself, says at the very beginning. And it's clear that he comes from the old line, an outstanding old line, which is, look, the guy lived all of his life. I'm taking him at his word. The guy lived all of his life sitting and learning. That's what he did. And posking and so on and so forth. He had a small kollel in Mantua. I won't go into that now. But he devoted himself in his way to Torah Avodah. And so did a whole host of others. And they had nothing to do with Kabbalah whatsoever. I mean, I think that Moshe Feinstein got into heaven. That's my opinion. You know what I mean? Or this one or any other way. You get what I'm saying? In other words, if you spend your whole life seriously and, and religiously in Nigla, that's a life well spent. Even though Kabbalah will tell you, oh, you didn't do the Kabbalah, therefore, you won't get into the right place in heaven. Nah. Most people say like this, if I can get as far as the Moshe Feinstein, that's pretty good. You understand? And so the debate goes on. But whether or not this thing should be, suppressed or not put in printing press, this was solved, whatever you think, back in the late 1550s. And Jewish history has never been the same since. So I end up by saying that, and there's more in this, but enough is enough. I end up by saying that this original copy was therefore a very controversial piece of Jewish literature along the lines I've just described. And that is what, and this original copy, meaning one of the Zohars that was published in several volumes, and it's in very good condition, of course, as you can see in the Genazim catalog, that's exactly what's up for sale. It'd be interesting to me to see, if I find out, who is it that actually goes and buys this, and what they do with it. But I've given my piece to that. As I said, I want to thank the Stefanskis and Gnozin for giving me the opportunity to say a little bit about this subject. And with that, soon I'm leaving and going back to Baltimore, and I'll resume hopefully from there.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.